overtime pay for Sunday work, and, in general, the opportunity to be doing something more valuable than just lying around. Kurt listened impassively, as he usually did, without any show of emotion. William Curtis Banks, a light-skinned African-American man in his late 20s, father of 2 children, a second-year graduate student proud to have made it into the world's top psychology department, was as hard-working and high-achieving as any student I had ever worked with. He had no time for frivolity, excess, weaknesses, excuses, or fools. Kurt kept his emotions to himself behind a stoic facade. Jim, 4325, who was also a reserved person, must have interpreted Kurt's detached manner as his being displeased. He hastened to add that these were not really grievances, rather just suggestions. Kurt thanked him politely for their suggestions and promised to share them with his superiors for their consideration. I wonder whether they noticed that he took no notes and that they had failed to give him their penciled list for the record. What was most important to our system was to provide the semblance of democracy in this authoritarian setting. However, citizen dissent demands changes in the system. If taken wisely, such change prevents open disobedience and rebellion. But when dissent is co-opted by the system, disobedience is curtailed and rebellion shelved. In fact, without getting any assurances of reasonable attempts to address any of their complaints, these elected officials had little likelihood of achieving any of their goals. The Stanford County Jail Prisoners' Grievance Committee failed in its main mission to make a dent in the system armor. However, they left feeling good about having openly vented and having some authority, even a low-level one, listen to their complaints. The prisoners make contact with the outside world. The prisoners' first letters were invitations to potential visitors, some of whom would be coming by tonight on this, the third day of the experiment. The second round of letters could be to visitors invited for the next visitor night, or to any friend or family member who was too far away to visit. After the prisoners composed them on our official stationery, the guards collected them for mailing, and, of course, as duly noted in one of the rules, they were screened for security. The following samples give some sense of what the prisoners were feeling, and at least in one case came as a major surprise to us. Handsome All-American Hubby, 7258, suggests to his girlfriend that she bring some interesting pictures or posters to break the boredom of sitting on a bed and staring at blank walls. Tough Guy, Zapata-mustached Rich, 1037, conveys his anger to a buddy. It's not like a job anymore. I'm fucked because you can't get out of here. Stu, 819, whose complaints had been increasing, sends mixed messages to his friend. The food here is as good and plentiful as the third day of Ebenezer's second voyage to Thailand. Not much happens here of interest. Basically, I sleep, shout my number, and get hassled. It'll be great to get out. The diminutive Asian-American prisoner, Glenn, 3401, makes clear his disdain for this place. Having a miserable time. Please firebomb Jordan Hall as a diversionary tactic. My buddies and I are damn frustrated. We intend to make a run for it as soon as possible, but first, I promise to crack a few craniums on the way out. Then he adds a puzzling P.S. Be careful not to let the nitwits know you're real. Real? The surprise came from a letter by nicotine-addicted Paul, 5704, the new leader of the prisoners. In that letter, 5704 does a stupid thing for a self-styled revolutionary. He tips off his girlfriend, in an unsecured letter, that he plans to write a story about his experience for a local underground newspaper when he gets out. He has discovered that the Office of Naval Research of the Department of Defense is supporting my research. Consequently, he has hatched a conspiracy theory, arguing that we are trying to find out how best to imprison student protesters who are opposing the Vietnam War. Obviously, he is not an experienced revolutionary because it was not smart to discuss his subversive plans in a letter that we would be likely to screen. Little did he know that I myself was a radical activist professor against the Vietnam War since 1966, when I had organized one of the nation's first all-night university teach-ins at New York University, organized a large-scale walkout at NYU's graduation ceremony to protest the university's awarding an honorary degree to Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, and in the last year, at Stanford, I had organized thousands of students into constructive challenges to the continuing war. I was a kindred political spirit, but not a mindlessly kindred revolutionary. His letter begins, "I've made arrangements with the Tribe and the Berkeley Barb, alternative free radical newspapers, to carry the story when I get out." 5704 then brags about his new status in our little prison community. "Today I've gotten together a grievance committee, of which I am chairman. Tomorrow I'm organizing a credit union for our collective wages." He goes on to describe that he is benefiting from this experience. "I'm learning a lot about revolutionary incarceration tactics. Guards accomplish nothing because you just can't keep the old freak morale down. Most of us here are freaks, and I don't really think anyone will crack before this thing is over. A few are starting to get servile, but they exert no influence on the rest of us." In addition, he signs off with a big, bold, "Your prisoner, 5704. I decide not to share this information with the guards, who might really abuse him in retaliation. But it is upsetting to think that my research grant status is being accused of being a tool of the administration's war machine, especially since I've worked to encourage effective dissent by student activists. That grant was originally given to fund empirical and conceptual research on the effects of anonymity, of conditions of de-individuation, and on interpersonal aggression. When the idea for the prison experiment occurred, I got the granting agency to extend the funding to pay for this research as well, without any other additional funding. I am angry that Paul, and probably his Berkeley buddies, are spreading this falsehood. Whether driven by his sporadic mood shifts, nicotine cravings, or his desire to make exciting material for his journalistic exposé, 5704 has created a lot of difficulty for all of us today, a day when we already had too much to handle. With the help of his cellmates, he also bent the bars on cell 1's door, for which he got hold time. While in the hold, he kicked down the partition between the two compartments, for which action he was denied lunch, and also received extended solitary time. He continues to be non-cooperative during dinner, and obviously upset that no one has come to visit him. Fortunately, following his meeting after dinner with the warden, who sternly rebuked him, we notice that 5704's behavior has changed for the better. Prepping for the visitors. The hypocritical masquerade. I had hoped Carlo would be able to come from Oakland to work with me on how best to prepare for the onslaught of parents. But as usual, his old car has broken down and is being repaired, hopefully in time for his scheduled appearance the next day as head of our parole board. After a long phone conversation, the game plan is set. We will do just what all prisons do when unwelcome visitors descend on them, ready to document abuses and confront the system with demands for improvement. Prison officials cover the bloodstains with doilies, hide the bodies by putting troublemakers out of sight, and make the scene pretty. Carlo offers sage advice about what I might do in the short time available to create the appearance to parents of a well-oiled benevolent system that is taking good care of their children while we are in charge of them. He makes it clear, however, that we must convince these middle-class white parents to believe in the good we are doing with the study and, like their sons, make them comply with the demands of the authorities. Carlo laughs as he says, "You white folks sure like to conform to the man, so they know they are doing the right thing, just doing like everyone else is doing." Turn on Action Central. Prisoners wash the floors and their cells. The hole sign is removed, and a disinfectant with a fresh eucalyptus scent is sprayed all over to counter the urine odors. The prisoners are shaved, sponge-washed, and as well-groomed as can be. Stocking caps and head towels are stashed away. Finally, the warden warns everyone that any complaints will result in premature termination of the visit. We ask the day shift to do overtime until 9 p.m., both to cope with the visitors and also to be ready to assist should the anticipated riot materialize. For good measure, I invite our entire group of backup guards to come in as well. Next, we feed our prisoners their best hot meal, chicken pot pie, with seconds, and double desserts for the gourmands among them. Music gently infuses the yard as the men eat. The day guards are serving the dinner while the night guards are watching. Without the laughter or snickering that usually accompanies the meals, the atmosphere is strangely civil and rather ordinary. Hellman is sitting at the head of the table, leaning back, but still showing his big club, prominently swinging it around.
2093, you never had it so good, did you?
2093 replies,
No, I haven't, Mr. Correctional Officer. Your mother never gave you seconds, did she?
No, she didn't, Mr. Correctional Officer,
Sarge replies obediently.
You see how good you've got it here, 2093?
Yes, I do, Mr. Correctional Officer.
Hellman picks some food from Sarge's plate and walks away, sneering at him. Bad blood is developing between them. Meanwhile, in the corridor outside the main prison door, we are making final preparations for the visitors, whose potential for making trouble is a realistic fear. Opposite the wall, housing the three offices of the guards, the warden, and the superintendent, are a dozen folding chairs for visitors while they await entry. As they come down into the basement, full of good humor at what seems a novel, fun experience, we deliberately and systematically bring their behavior under situational control, according to plan. They have to be taught that they are our guests, to whom we were granting the privilege of visiting their sons, brothers, friends, and lovers. Susie Phillips, our attractive receptionist, welcomes the visitors warmly. She is seated behind a large desk with a dozen fragrant red roses at one side. Susie is another of my students, a psychology major and also a Stanford Dolly, chosen for the cheerleading team for her good looks and gymnastic abilities. She signs each visitor in, noting time of arrival, number in party, and name and number of the inmate he or she will visit. Susie informs them of the procedure that must be followed tonight. First, each visitor or group sees the warden for a briefing, after which they can go into the prison when their relative or friend has finished his dinner. On the way out, they are to meet with the superintendent to discuss any concerns they may have or to share their reactions. They agree to these terms and then sit and wait while they listen to music piped in over the intercom. Susie apologizes for their having to wait so long, but it seems that the prisoners are taking a longer time than usual tonight because they are enjoying double desserts. That does not sit well with some visitors, who have other things to do and are getting impatient to see their prisoner and this unusual prison place. After conferring with the warden, our receptionist informs the visitors that because the prisoners have taken so long to eat, we will have to limit the visiting time to 10 minutes and admit only 2 visitors per inmate. The visitors grumble. They are upset with their kids and friends for being so inconsiderate.
Why just 2 of us? They ask.
Susie replies that the space inside is very tight, and there is a fire law about maximum occupancy. She adds, as an aside,
Didn't your child or friend tell you about the limit of 2 visitors when he invited you here?
Damn. No, he didn't.
I'm sorry. I guess it must have slipped his mind. But now you will know next time you visit.
The visitors try to make the best of it, chatting among themselves about this interesting study. Some complain about the arbitrary rules, but, remarkably, they meekly comply with them, as good guests do. We have set the stage for them to believe what they are seeing in this lovely place is standard, and to distrust what they might hear from their irresponsible, selfish kids and buddies who are likely to complain. And so they, too, become unwitting participants in the prison drama we are staging. Up-close and impersonal visits. Prisoner 819's parents are the first to enter the yard, looking around curiously when they notice their son seated at the end of the long table in the middle of the corridor. Father asks the guard, "Can I shake hands with him?"
"Sure, why not?"
he answers, surprised by the request. Then his mother also shakes hands with her son.
Shakes hands?
No automatic hugging of parents and their child? This kind of awkward exchange involving minimal body contact is what happens when one is visiting a real maximum security prison. But we never made that a condition for visiting in our prison. It was our pre-visit manipulation of the visitor's expectations that worked to create confusion about what behaviors were appropriate in this strange place. When in doubt, do the minimal amount. Burdan is standing over the prisoner and his parents. Hellman comes and goes at will, invading the privacy of 819's interaction with his folks. He looms over 819 as this little familial triad pretends to ignore him and carry on a normal conversation. However, 819 knows that he has no chance to say anything bad about the prison, or he will suffer later. His parents cut their visit short to only 5 minutes so that 819's brother and sister can share some of the limited visiting. They shake hands again as they say their goodbyes.
"Yeah, things are pretty good here,"
Stu, 819, tells his siblings. They and other friends of the prisoners act a lot differently from the uptight ways of the generally more intense parents. They are more casual, more amused, and not as intimidated by the situational constraints as the parents. But guards are hovering over everyone. 819 continues.
"We have some pleasant conversations with the correctional officers."
He describes the hole for punishment, and as he points toward it, Burdan interrupts,
"No more talking about the hole, 819.
The sister asks about the number on his smock and wants to know what they do all day. 819 answers her questions and also describes the impact of the police arrest. As soon as he begins to talk about problems he has with the night guard shift, Burdan again stops him cold. 819.
"They get us up early in the morning. Some guards are really good, top correctional officers. There's not really any physical abuse. They do have clubs, but..."
His brother asks him what he would do if he could get out. 819 answers, as a good prisoner should,
"I can't be out there. I am in this wonderful place."
Burdan ends the visit after precisely 5 minutes. Saros has been sitting at the table the entire time, with Varnish standing behind the table. The guards outnumber the guests. 819's face turns grim as his guests smilingly wave goodbye. In come the mom and dad of prisoner Rich, 1037. Burdan immediately sits down on the table, glowering over them. I notice for the first time that Burdan looks like a sinister Che Guevara. 1037.
"Yesterday was kind of strange. Today we washed all the walls in here and cleaned our cells in here. We don't have a sense of time. We haven't been out to see the sun."
His dad asks whether they will stay inside for the entire 2 weeks. Son is not sure, but imagines that is the case. The visit seems to be going well. The conversation is animated, but Mom shows that she is worried about her son's appearance. John Landry saunters over to chat with Burdan as both stand within hearing of the visitor's conversation. 1037 does not mention that the guards have taken away his bed, and so he is sleeping on the floor.
"Thanks for coming,"
1037 says with feeling.
"I'm glad I came. See you soon. Day after tomorrow, for sure."
Mom comes back when 1037 asks her to call someone on his behalf.
"Now you be good and follow the rules," she urges her son.
Dad gently ushers her out the door, aware that they might be staying overtime in their visit and preventing others from the chance to enjoy visiting privileges. The guards all perk up when they spy Hubby, 7258's attractive girlfriend, enter the yard. She is carrying a box of cupcakes, which she wisely shares with them. The guards eagerly munch them down, making hearty sounds for the benefit of their captives. 7258 is allowed to eat one cupcake while he and his girl get into an animated conversation. They seem to be trying hard to be oblivious of the guards breathing down their necks. All the while, Burdan hovers next to them, rapping his club on the table in staccato. The intercom background music is playing the Rolling Stones hit, Time is on My Side. This irony is missed as visitors come and go for their all-too-brief encounter. Mother knows best, but Dad and I do her in. I thank each of the visitors for taking time from their busy schedules to make this visit. Like the warden, I try to be as accommodating and congenial as possible. I add that I hope they appreciate what we are to do by studying prison life in as realistic a fashion as possible within the limits of an experiment. I answer their questions about future visits, about sending gift boxes, and counter their personal asides, urging that I especially look after their son. It is all going like clockwork, only a few more visitors to process before I can turn my full attention to dealing with the expected danger to our dungeon. However, thinking ahead to the next game, I am blindsided by 1037's mother. I am not prepared for the intensity of her distress. As soon as she and Dad enter my office, she says in a quavering voice,
"I don't mean to make trouble, sir, but I am worried about my son. I've never seen him looking so tired."
Red alert! She could make trouble for our prison. And she is right. 1037 looks terrible, not only physically exhausted, but depressed. He is one of the most raggedy-looking kids of the entire lot. What seems to be your son's problem? This reaction is immediate, automatic, and like that of every authority confronted by a challenge to the operating procedures of his system. Like all other perpetrators of institutional abuse, I ascribe the problem of her son as dispositional, as his problem, as something wrong in him. She is having none of that diversionary tactic. Mom continues on to say that he looks so haggard, has not been sleeping through the night, and... Does he have a sleep disorder?
No. He says that the guards wake them up for something called counts.
Yes, of course, the counts. When each new shift of guards comes on duty, they must be sure the men are all present and accounted for, so they have them count off their numbers.
But in the middle of the night?
Our guards work 8-hour shifts, and since one group of them starts at 2 a.m., they have to wake up the prisoners to be sure they are all there, that none have escaped. Doesn't that make sense to you?
Yes, but I'm not sure that...
She is still primed to make trouble, so I move on to another more potent tactic and engage Dad, who has been silent. Looking him straight in the eye, I put his masculine pride at risk. Excuse me, sir, don't you think that your son can take it?
Well, sure he can. He's a real leader, you know. Captain of the... and...
Only half listening to the words, but understanding their tone and accompanying gestures, I bond with Dad. I'm with you. Your son seems to have the right stuff to handle this tough situation. Turning back to Mom, I add to reassure her, rest assured that I will keep an eye on your boy. Thanks for coming. Hope to see you again soon. Dad grips my hand firmly in a manly shake as I wink at him with the assurance of the boss who is on his side. We silently acknowledge that we will tolerate the little lady's overreaction. What swine we are, and we do it all on automatic masculine pilot. As a postscript to this smarmy episode, I received a tender letter from Mrs. Y., written that same night. Her observations and intuition about our prison situation and her son's condition were completely accurate.
My husband and I visited our son at the Stanford County Prison. It seemed very real to me. I'd not expected anything so severe, nor had my son when he volunteered, I'm sure. It gave me a depressed feeling when I saw him. He looked very haggard, and his chief complaint seemed to be that he had not seen the sun for so long. I asked if he was sorry he volunteered, and he answered that at first he had been. However, he had gone through several different moods, and he was more resigned. This will be the hardest money he will ever earn in his life, I'm sure. Mother of 1037. P.S. We hope this project is a big success.
Although I am getting ahead of our story, I should add here that her son, Rich, 1037, one of the original band of tough rebels, had to be released from our prison in the next few days because he was suffering from acute stress reactions that were overwhelming him. His mother had sensed that change coming over him. Disguised abandonment to foil the rioters. Once the last visitor had left, we could all breathe a collective sigh of relief that the rioters had not crashed into our party when we were most vulnerable. But the threat was not over. Now it was time to swing into counterinsurgency mode. Our plan was for some guards to dismantle the jail props to give the appearance of disarray. Other guards would chain the prisoners' legs together, put bags over their heads, and escort them in the elevator from our basement to a rarely used large fifth-floor storage room, safe from invasion. When the conspirators charged in to liberate the jail, I would be sitting there all alone and would tell them that the experiment was over. We had ended it early and sent everyone home, so they were too late to liberate anything. After they checked out the place and left, we'd bring the prisoners back down and have time to redouble the security of our prison. We even thought of ways to capture 8612 and imprison him again if he was among the conspirators because he had been released under false pretenses. Picture this scene. I am sitting alone in a vacant corridor, formerly AKA The Yard. The remnants of the Stanford County Jail are strewn about in disorder. Prison cell doors off their hinges, signs down, the front door wide open. I am psyched to spring what we consider to be our ingenious Machiavellian counterplot. Instead of the rioters who should appear but one of my psychology colleagues, an old friend, a very serious scholar, and my graduate school roommate. Gordon asks, "What's going on here?" He and his wife saw the bunch of prisoners up on the fifth floor and felt sorry for them. They went out and bought the prisoners a box of donuts because they all looked so miserable. I described the research as simply and quickly as possible, all the while expecting the sudden intrusion of the invaders. This scholarly intruder then poses a simple question. "Say, what's the independent variable in your study?" I should have answered that it was the allocation of pre-tested volunteer subjects to the roles of prisoner or guard, which of course had been randomly assigned. Instead, I get angry. Here I had an incipient prison riot on my hands. The security of my men and the stability of my prison were at stake, and I had to contend with this bleeding-heart, liberal, academic, effete professor whose only concern was a ridiculous thing like an independent variable. I thought to myself, the next thing he'd be asking was whether I had a rehabilitation program. The dummy. I adroitly dismiss him and get back to the business of waiting for the attack to unfold. I wait and wait. Finally, I realize that it is all a rumor. No substance to it at all. We had spent many hours and expended a great deal of energy in planning to foil the rumored attack. I had foolishly gone begging to the police for their aid. We had cleaned out a filthy storage room upstairs, dismantled our prison, and moved the prisoners up and out. More important, we had wasted valuable time. And our biggest sin, as researchers, is that we had not collected any systematic data the whole day. All this from someone who has a professional interest in rumor transmission and distortion, and who regularly does class demonstrations of such phenomena. We mortals can be fools, especially when mortal emotions rule over cool reason. We resurrected the prison props, and then moved the prisoners back down from the hot, stuffy, windowless storage room where they had been stored for 3 mindless hours. What humiliation I suffered. Craig, Kurt, Dave, and I could barely make eye contact for the rest of that evening. We tacitly agreed to keep it all to ourselves and not declare it Dr. Z's folly. We played the fools, but who will pay the piper? Obviously, we all reacted with considerable frustration. We also suffered the tension of cognitive dissonance for so readily and firmly believing a lie and committing ourselves to much needless action without sufficient justification. We had also experienced groupthink. Once I, as leader, believed the rumor to be valid, everyone else accepted it as true. No one played devil's advocate, a figure that every group needs to avoid foolish or even disastrous decisions like this. It was reminiscent of President John Kennedy's disastrous decision to invade Cuba in the Bay of Pigs fiasco. It should also have been apparent to me that we were losing the scientific detachment essential for conducting any research with unbiased objectivity. I was well on the way to becoming a prison superintendent rather than a principal investigator. It should have been obvious that this was so from my earlier encounter with Mrs. Y and her husband, not to mention my tantrums with the police sergeant. However, even psychologists are people, subject to the same dynamic processes at a personal level that they study at a professional level. Our general sense of frustration and embarrassment spread silently across the prison yard. In retrospect, we should have just admitted our mistake and moved on. But that is one of the hardest things that anyone can ever do. Just say it. I made a mistake. Sorry. Instead, we unconsciously looked for scapegoats to deflect blame from ourselves. And we did not have to look far. All around us were prisoners who were going to pay the price for our failure and embarrassment.